Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. How do you know if your clutter is out of control? When does a prized collection grow into a health hazard? Why do people hold on to items they don't need or don't have any room to store? Research suggests that 2 to 6% of the population, as many as 19 million Americans, suffer from compulsive hoarding. Many suffer in silence, ashamed of the piles that crowd their homes, or afraid that seeking help will result in eviction or a call to social services. My guest today is Elaine Birchall, who spent 3 decades as a social worker and founded the Canadian National Hoarding Coalition. She's also co-author with Susan Cronkwright of Conquer the Clutter, Strategies to Identify, Manage, and Overcome Hoarding. Elaine Birchall joins us from Ottawa, Ontario. Elaine, welcome to the show.
Wonderful to be here.
Let's start with identifying hoarding. Many of us might picture a dangerously filled house. What other criteria are required for a diagnosis?
The first criteria is there must be what most people would describe as an excessive accumulation, and I say a failure to resolve that proportionately. Now, that does not mean that trite method of one thing in and one thing out. If you're on that continuum of one thing in and one thing out, you're nowhere near hoarding at this point in your life. The second essential criteria is that some or all of the living spaces can no longer be used for their intended purpose. And the third criteria is somebody's distressed, or if they're not actively distressed, they have a legitimate right to be concerned about the condition of the property if only they knew the truth about it. And that involves your mortgage company, your home insurance, your landlord, fire department, children's services, animal control, services to the elderly, and your neighbors, who may actually be at more risk than you are, because despite the level of risk that you're actively living with, they're living with the unknown, and they don't know enough to take precautions to make sure that they can get out in case of an emergency.
So, in simplest terms, how is a hoard different from clutter?
By degree and by what is underpinning it. So, clutter is less accumulation, and also the person living with that clutter has a much easier time dealing with it and resolving it, because that fundamental relationship we all have with our things, if we keep them, isn't as profound, and it isn't usually complicated by additional, what we call comorbidities, other mental health or physical health conditions.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is that the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which defines psychiatric diagnoses, used to list severe hoarding as a subset of OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. In 2013, that was revised to list hoarding as a disorder in its own right. So how are they different?
They're different because we now know more. That was a preliminary assessment with hoarding being under OCD. We didn't know enough. And it was only when we backed up and we started to do better research, more broad-based, that individuals with ADD and ADHD, for instance, were saying, I've got a hoarding problem. People who had social phobia, my stuff is out of control. And then we started to look elsewhere. And then a more in-depth assessment was done. And it was said, no, this is a compulsive disorder. And of the population who are at higher risk of also developing hoarding, it's not because of the comorbidity like OCD or ADD or ADHD, but that's the thing that feeds part of this disorder.
Well, tell me more about who we know develops a hoarding disorder.
I break it down into three paths, Sheila. The first path is genetics. We do know, there's good research, that there are three distinct chromosomes with markers in common in some types of hoarding. And we know what those chromosomes are. So imagine, too, if that exists in a family, imagine the power, in addition to that, of modeling behavior. The other thing we know about the three paths is that those comorbidities that I was mentioning before, there's a pretty defined but a large list of other mental health and some physical health situations, Parkinson's and MS being two of them, they put you at a higher risk. It's not a dead certainty, Sheila, that you're going to also develop hoarding disorder. But there are pretty, at this point, well-known percentage risks. The third path is one that I think is particularly scary, because I don't believe that under the right conditions, most of us are safe from this. And that is, you fight with clutter. You know, it builds up. Just the amount of unwanted paper that comes into our home every day, it builds up. And often we don't stay ahead of the mail. We don't stay ahead of the newspapers. We don't stay ahead of the flyers. And then something happens, a major event in life. And that happens to all of us, Sheila. Or a series of smaller events, but they happen in a compressed period of time. And we can't restabilize in between those events. And they bring us to our knees. And then what is true of all hoarding is we then devolve into a profound state of overwhelmed. And that state of overwhelmed is the thing I want all of your listeners to watch out for. Because when you become overwhelmed, whatever you're vulnerable to, you're now at a higher risk of also having as a life challenge.
This is On the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with social worker Elaine Birchall about compulsive hoarding disorder, how it develops and how it affects individuals and families. It's hard to understand why people don't just throw away something, especially if it's damaged or dirty or expired. So tease that out for us.
In its simplest terms, it breaks down to that relationship, right? And we end up with three saving patterns. You either love it and it's aesthetically so pleasing to you and you don't see it for what it is. You see only the positives because you have this deep, profound relationship with that type of thing. The next is intrinsic. If we can convince ourselves that this makes sense and that this thing actually has value, I paid a lot of money for it, and I haven't had, or I've paid good money for it is usually the term, and I haven't had that much use out of it. So if I just keep it, even though I'm not using it, somehow that's like putting the money back in the bank. And then I could use it for something else. I know that they're all of those yogurt containers, for instance, have tremendous transferable use to many, many people. And that third one is sentimental. Sentimental saving is usually grief-based. And so it's that thing I miss that's gone, either a person, a time in my life, a job, something that I excelled at, and it's evidence that at one point in my life I wasn't in this situation. I mattered to me. That, if I keep it, it's somehow like I haven't entirely lost, or it's evidence that at one time I was that person or I was loved. And people forget, they just don't realize that relationship is in your body and in your mind, and it has nothing to do with the thing.
What risks does hoarding disorder pose?
Well, first of all, peace of mind in the life you were meant to have. That's number one. Number two, depending on the combustible, the amount of combustible material in your environment that you're saving, the risk of fire. Now, because the more the piles build up, Sheila, the more they tend to become implicated with heat sources around mm-hmm. furnaces, hot water tanks, stoves, fireplaces, the standalone heaters, electrical cords that get chewed because vermin start to burrow and you don't even know they're there and they chew. And then a fire happens. And the more combustible material you have, the faster your place is going to go up. The other thing that it's very, very serious is eviction or the threat of eviction. If you do get evicted and then you don't have another place to go, because hoarding is not an inexpensive habit or behavior, then you're on the street. Or you're couch surfing for a while and then you're homeless. And your social determinants of health, your mental health, your physical health, your spiritual health plummet. And it is very hard for people to reestablish stable housing if they have been evicted and ended up homeless.
When you were telling us about the criteria for diagnosis, you talked about hoarding behavior causing concern or distress, mm-hmm. not necessarily the person themselves. I mean, what if the person who's doing it is in denial about how much it has affected their life?
Quite often, and that denial is part of human nature. We all, this is not an us and them thing. I think that third path that we talked about, I think that is a common tripping hazard for most of us. And we can only afford to look at what we feel able to deal with, that we feel we have the ability, and we feel we have the resources. And one of the ironic things about an overaccumulation of things is the more you have, Sheila, the less you can find. You probably do have the resources, like the tangible resources you need to declutter, but you can't find them. And so you go out and you buy more because you can't find them.
We need to take a quick break here on the record. I'm Sheila Cass. My guest is social worker and hoarding disorder expert Elaine Birchall. When we're back, how compulsive shopping and hoarding disorder can go hand in hand. I'm Sheila Cass. This is On the Record. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Quote, I am always afraid of being judged. I don't ever think I'm doing well enough. It's like I have blinders on and I only notice when there's a buildup. Close quote. That's part of what a client told social worker and hoarding expert Elaine Birchall, describing how difficult it was to ask for help. We're speaking with Elaine Birchall about the book she co-wrote, Conquer the Clutter. It offers tools to help people identify and overcome compulsive hoarding. Elaine, in the book you reflect on some of the people you have worked with, and one woman, Catherine, is living in a condo filled with the consequences of what you call retail therapy. Tell what you learned about how Catherine's hoarding began.
Well, Catherine is a pretty profound situation, example of hoarding, actually. She was an elderly lady in her 70s, and she was having, the important thing was her mobility was limited. And, you know, one of the ways that Catherine gave herself that little jolt of joy that we all need and seek on a regular basis to make life just a little more manageable mentally was the Hamster Schlemmer catalog. And she just loved it because it had so many unique objects, and they were usually the answer to some problem that she was facing or that she wanted to resolve. So that retail therapy was a distraction away from the reality. And so when I started to work with Catherine, you know, Sheila, when you work with people and you get to know them and you think you know the problem, and that is actually part of the issue they're dealing with, you always just have a little bell that rings that says, this just isn't adding up. There's something I don't know. There's an unidentified piece here. It's so important if you're going to do hoarding work. And so one day, our goal, working with Catherine, was to get the condo ready. Her sister was going to move up from the United States to Ottawa and live with her to help her face this devolution of her health. And we needed to get the condo ready, just as far as opening up space for the sister to live there. And we were finally got to the back bedroom. And one of the first things you do when you're trying to make space for the I Can Love It items is you look at the storage and the use of it. So we were working on a cupboard, and I reached up and I pulled down a small suitcase. And she said, you might want to be careful with that, Elaine. And you could just tell by her demeanor and her voice that this was the moment. And so I said, do you want to tell me about it? And she said, well, I probably should have told you about this a long time ago. I said, okay, well, now's the time, do you think? And we sat down, and she shared with me that she had had two children, two boys. They were 4 and 5, and she was a stay-at-home mom at the time, and they got out of the backyard. They got down to the river, and both of them drowned.
Oh my.
And she, of course, was profoundly affected by that. But as if that wasn't bad enough, she said, no matter where I went, I couldn't even go to the store like 3 years later when people would whisper, and say, oh, that's the woman who lost her children. They drowned, you know. And she said, it made me crazy. There was no safe place for me to heal. And so I came up here to live with my sister in Ottawa. And I got a job and I built a life here. And so that one area, there was, interestingly enough, in this condo, there was a fairly sizable space behind doors that was a storage area. And I kept saying to her every time we needed to find space for something she really, really wanted to keep, well, why don't we have a look at that storage area? Maybe there are things in there that aren't as important to you. And, well, that was kind of we did a little work in there, but we didn't get very far. And I just couldn't understand what the block was, because she wasn't that way with any other space. And it turned out that the things that were in that storage area were material to write children's books. And she explained to me later, those were the books that it was so important for me to write, because those were the stories I would like to have told my children. And somehow, even though I'm in my 70s now, it would help me to heal a little more, knowing that those stories, somebody else was reading those stories to their children. And being a hoarding behavior and intervention specialist has been a very humbling experience for me, because for whatever skill I have, you can know the academics, but my clients have been so generous in teaching me what works and what doesn't work, and how important it is to be respectful of their logic and work with them at their pace. Because even though this looks very bizarre when it's spread all over the environment, there are good reasons why people get stuck and hoarding is just one of them.
That's social worker Elaine Birchall here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her book, Conquer the Clutter, Strategies to Identify, Manage, and Overcome Hoarding. You use the word overcome. Can someone be cured of hoarding disorder?
It depends on how early hoarding, the onset of hoarding, and how long you've been doing it unidentified and unsupported. So the earlier and the longer, the poorer the prognosis. But what everyone can do, so long as there is no cognitive impairment, severe cognitive impairment, what everyone can do is learn to manage it.
What mistakes do family and friends make when if they're trying to be supportive?
Well, the first thing they do is they immediately focus on the stuff rather than the person because, of course, the distress has built up in their mind as well. And then they try to make it about getting rid of things and discarding and clearing and cleaning up. When, why would anybody who has a profound relationship with something embrace working with someone when you know it's about they're going to get rid of your stuff? The approach that I've developed, thanks to my clients teaching me this, is let's first focus on what is the most important here, because when things are all in a jumble together, usually it's not unusual that everything in that jumble takes on the importance and value of the most important thing that you know is there. When you can start to separate those things out, you can start to see them and feel them for what they are. So go for what the keeps are, the absolute most important keeps.
Where can individuals and families find support in Maryland?
So I would recommend that if people have this disorder to a disruptive, functionally disruptive degree, family who love them and the person themselves looking for help, contact your hoarding task force in Gaithersburg, Maryland. It's a resource list for working with hoarding situations, and Gaithersburg Hoarding Task Force is a unique collection of social workers and other professionals. That's your go-to. That's your best go-to in Maryland.
We will link to that from our website at WIPR. Thank you so much for talking to us about this.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Sheila.
Social worker Elaine Birchall founded the Canadian National Hoarding Coalition. Her book, co-authored with Suzanne Cronkwright, is Conquer the Clutter, Strategies to Identify, Manage, and Overcome Hoarding. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to resources and more information. I'm Sheila Cass, very glad you're with us on The Record. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.